Well, welcome to our daily work, our daily lives. It's great to see you all here. My name is John Beck. I'm the co-director of our daily work, our daily lives. This is I believe we're coming into the middle of our 22nd year of this brown bag series. And we're already lining up speakers for next year. So we're going to be very happy to have Darcy Green join us because she's going to have an exhibit here at the museum of photographs of Africa and workers there. Benin, do I remember? And so we're fired up about that. We've got all sorts of other things. I just arranged my first musical brown bag for next November. We're going to have a wonderful Appalachian banjo and guitar player who is going to be in town, so we're looking forward to that. But let me tell you about what's coming up, and then I will introduce our speaker today and get to it. What we're really fired up about, March is going to be pretty amazing. So I have to tell you that not only do we have daytime events, we also have nighttime events, and many of them theatrical in nature. So the first one is Karen Varanche is coming back, and for those of you who did not hear her last year, it was virtually an out-of-body experience because she basically becomes Mother Jones, often called the Miner's Angel, once dubbed the most dangerous woman in America. And Karen does this one-woman show where she is Mother Jones speaking to, I believe, a 1915 or so era local union meeting. So when people ask her questions like, well, what do you think of Donald Trump? She'll say, who's that? Because she has to play it straight until afterward when she's willing to talk about contemporary labor movement and everything else. But I commend coming to this. It's going to be in Lansing, Grand Rapids, and in Flint. So tell all your friends. All of them are free and open to the public. So I told Beth that she gets to be the person who has to make the stretch. I'll actually come your way. Second, we have two brown bags in March. The first, we're very happy to have Jose Moreno and Dionisio Valdez back. They're going to be talking about the United Farm Worker Grape Boycott in urban America, 1965 to 1970. That's coming up in March. Also coming up in March, and we're really fired up about this, because Amy Goldstein won two awards for her book Janesville already, and very well may end up winning more. But she's going to be here on March 26th in a brown bag during the day, and she's doing a nighttime lecture down at the Ari Olds Museum, and both of those are free and open to the public. This one only describes the daytime event. I will send around her book for you to see. She won the Financial Times Best Business Book, and also another similar kind of Best Business Book for the year. This is the rest of the spring season. So those are coming around. Now, one thing that we have the night after Amy, and we are still arranging this, but on April 2nd, Lynn Nataj, who got the Pulitzer Prize for her plays, is going to be at Wharton. And any of you who are faculty, staff, or students can get free tickets at Wharton. Everyone else has to pay perfectly good money to see her. But she will be at Wharton on April 2nd. Earlier that day, we actually have a brown bag about her work. And the Tuesday before, we're doing a staged reading of some scenes from her prize-winning play, Sweat, which is about a plant closure, an unbelievable play about plant closure. So we're going to have all sorts of fun going on in March, so we look forward to having you come to everything. So let me tell you about today's speaker and get it going. Shirley Vida is the history curator here at the museum, and she currently has a wonderful show on the ground floor in the main gallery on World War I and posters about World War I. You might think of it as kind of one of the first big commercial enterprises of the 20th century. But part of that was really anti-labor, anti-radical propaganda as well, because the fact that there was real attacks on the industrial workers of the world, among others, in terms of their role being against the war. So Shirley got her PhD at the University of Pennsylvania in material culture and museum studies. She's taught at Kent State, Youngstown State, and goes back to her roots in Ohio, actually coming out of a mill factory family and farming background as well. So we're very happy to have Shirley here today talking about that exhibit. Afterward, she is going to be willing to walk you around the exhibit as a museum gallery walk. So any of you who want to stay around for that, please do. But and do send those sign-in sheets around. We'd love to have you sign up so we know that you're here. So with that, please give a warm welcome to Shirley Vida talking about A War of Words, Labor and Anti-Radical Propaganda During World War I.
Thank you. I'm really nervous because I've worked on this just a little bit, so you're going to get a more intro to some of the thinking that came out of the research for War and Speech, so I hope you'll be patient with me. I also want to tell a story about my life, since John brought it up, as a child and grandchild of immigrants. My grandfather, Jan Vida, came over from Poland to work in the mills in Cleveland. I actually started off in the oil fields in western Pennsylvania, went to Cleveland. One day on a May Day parade in Youngstown, he went down to Cleveland, or he went from Cleveland to Youngstown and saw this young woman who ended up becoming his wife. They had 10 kids. He worked at Republic in the 1930s and 40s. I worked at Republic in the 1970s. So there's this kind of family tradition here. He got his citizenship in World War I. He fought in the Argonne Forest. He was wounded on November 2nd, 1918. He woke up in a hospital once the armistice was over. He had a head wound, but survived, came back, and had 10 kids. So there we are. So World War I kind of means something to me because it's actually part of my family history. So my original purpose in War and Speech, Propaganda, Patriotism, and Dissent in the Great War, was to engage visitors in three ways. To tell a story of the World War I home front through the Michigan State University's excellent World War I poster collection. To engage discussions about the first sustained instance of government propaganda and concomitant suppression of speech, especially in the current context of fake news. And following from this, to provide historical examples with which to teach media literacy, as many in our society are currently calling for. As is typical in these sorts of productions, original intents are altered and improved, components deleted for lack of space. Unlike in books, I cannot use footnotes to display those aspects of the exhibition currently on view. And that's the bad news for me. It's also typical to realize through the same research process a hidden exhibition comprised of other, sometimes unexpected stories that compel you to create yet another research folder on your desktop screen. This is the good news. When this happens, you as a historian realize how serendipitous or haphazard, dependent on your mood, your training and research and everyday work as a curator have brought you to this place of realization. It's either that aha movement or the palm to forehead thunk that we all have when we realize what's in front of us. So I'm grateful to John Beck for offering me a space and time on the schedule and for figuring out the title of this talk, which happened as I was going home to Thanksgiving in the car driving through Cleveland, though I'm not sure I will come close to fulfilling his promise. My forehead is still smarting from that thunk of recognition. I am still gathering and working through the political, visual, and material culture of World War I to make visible what propaganda actually papered over, and to evaluate just what anti-radical propaganda did and what its effect on American labor was. Government propaganda was always anti-radical, but it hasn't consistently been considered in those terms or in terms of labor or work studies. So what I'm going to try to do for you today is share some episodes from and in the material and visual evidence I've been from and in the material and visual evidence I've been sifting and sorting to offer you a sense of the project. Now, I'm not trained as a labor historian. Rather, my training and research career has been devoted to the study of material and visual culture and everyday life. As such, I necessarily think about work and about making, about consuming, about reception, even about trash, refuse, and garbage. And I could talk about that another day. Think, for example, though, in terms of material culture, thinking materially about a poster that you see digitally on the screen, unfortunately, of the simple poster, Eat War Bread. This poster seems straightforward in its messaging and design. Indeed, the design and message appear happily merged in the poster's insistence. What goes overlooked is that little mark at the center bottom of the paper sheet, and I'm sorry for the bad image. This is a union label. It's also called a printer's union bug, first used in 1893. Since then, Americans have been asked to look for the union label, but only in 2002 did the Progressive Librarians Guild publish a proposal to include union label descriptions in bibliographic and archival cataloging. Museums and historical societies are rather lagging in following that. Over 100 years of union labor and identification and identity has been written out of the history of the documents that bear it. The message of unionization, workmanship, and quality standards and union working conditions it represents are invisible in catalogs. In the case of this poster, the union label represents the Allied Printing Trades Council of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Milwaukee was one city of many in the United States before the Great War, in which city councils required union labels to be printed, thus attempting to encourage unionization of print shops and rejecting low bidding from non-union shops. It's interesting, there are court cases that are really fascinating, I haven't been going through them all yet, about non-union shops, applying to courts for injunctions, arguing with these city councils about whether that's fair bidding or not, that's fair competition or not. It's a great, interesting story that I didn't know about before I started this research. From my research, however, this union label reminded me to think more strategically about what the state had papered over in its posters and propaganda. The federal government also papered over emerging sectors of labor, in particular, women in the employment of the federal government. In what was described by the radical magazine, The Masses, women workers at the Bureau of Engraving and Imprinting were kept in liberty bondage for all the liberty bonds they were printing to fund the war effort. And this was especially true of the first liberty bond drive in 1917. At the request of Representative Jeanette Rankin of Montana, an undercover investigator gathered evidence of working conditions at the Bureau in early 1917. The investigator, Elizabeth Watson, who should have a book written about her, and I'll tell you why, she had a lot of experience. She had pretended to be a convict at New York's Auburn prison in order to figure out what was going on there. She was a detective in the Gulf Coast oyster and shrimp canneries for the National Child Labor Committee. And she investigated other places as well. Watson found that the Bureau printing press workers lifted their arms over their heads more than 6,000 times a day. To meet demand, women and men were working up to 16-hour days, with the Bureau supplying beds and a local hospital to save employees the time of traveling to and from work in order to get these Liberty Bonds issued or printed. Machines, not people, set the pace, and the long hours tasked women's eyes. Women also were harassed by men in management. I should say that the Bureau of Printing and Engraving was way behind what printing was all about by the 19-teens. Somehow the government refused to have more mechanized electric-powered presses that didn't, you know, that could roll, basically. At this point, they're still using hand presses where you're basically lifting and coming down, lifting and coming down, re-inking a plate, lifting and coming down. Some women are doing that, but other women are still lifting their arms and running around because you have to wet the paper in order to print it. And there are other machines for that. Then there are cutting machines and drying machines. And so it was a labor-intensive process that really wore you down pretty quickly. Also, of course, women got paid less than men for the same job. News of Rankin's investigation, let me give you another picture to look at. So I should tell you that the making postage stamps, the Bureau of Engraving and Printing does that too, is in the old building, which is now used by the Holocaust Museum. And then the new building in 1914 here, even though they did not, by 1914, they had a five-year plan to finally upgrade and modernize the machines. News of Rankin's investigation appeared in newspapers in June and July of 1917 and prompted Treasury Secretary William McAdoo to order a special committee to investigate the Bureau's working conditions. The eight-hour day was restored, but subsequent appeals for higher wages were rejected by Congress throughout the rest of the war. This incident perhaps preempted the ways in which women and the federal government would be presented in the nation's propaganda. Occurring at the same time the government's Committee on Public Information was being formed to organize and control war information and the nation's message, the Bureau labor controversy and hearings threatened to undermine the First Liberty Loan's success, though it would be oversubscribed by 50%. The First Liberty Loan, I should also add, was really pitched to the wealthiest Americans. So the oversubscription really did not talk about working class people or even middle class people, if you could actually talk about a middle class at this time. So we're really talking about an oversubscription of the wealthiest without an income tax and all the other sort of things. Okay. Although the Division of Pictorial Publicity, the visual propaganda arm of the Committee on Public Information, was not fully in place until November 1917, a case may be made with more research that certain imagery was off limits. I should point out that the United States declares war on April 6, 1917. On April 13, 1917, Woodrow Wilson sets up the Committee for Public Information. That's under newspaperman George Creel. And what was called the Creel Commission basically controlled news, controlled what was on a billboard, controlled films, what was going in and was going out, really had an incredibly long reach and wide reach. The Division for Pictorial Publicity is set up by the end of April informally with artists, not with lithographers, not with lithography companies or any sort of workers, not any representation from unions making up the printing trades at all. And I think that has helped skew the way we actually understand how this propaganda worked in World War I. Of the 1,438 images of the Division of Pictorial Publicity created for the war effort, none depict women in home front clerical or industrial work beyond munitions. And I think stenography I have in here. George Creel, the head of the Committee on Public Information, considered civilian work the second line of defense in winning the war, but certain labor sectors were entirely omitted from view in these posters. Women are depicted as mothers and wives, sexualized objects or domesticated. These are both by Howard Chandler Christie of the Christie Girl fame. As victims, and we have both of these in the exhibit downstairs. Women are depicted as Hello Girls, which were only about 400 women who went overseas to be telephone operators. And then you also see the stenographers in DC, a recruitment poster of another sort. And they are seen as munitions workers. I especially like the poster on the right. It really does have a kind of Russian sensibility to it. And I have to say, when you look online in these World War I poster repositories at the Library of Congress or the Huntington or many university libraries and museums, these two actually get switched because of the title. So it's kind of unclear what you're seeing. One is definitely different than the other, but I've seen this is a consistent mistake that I see in other repositories. When it came to the bureaucratic creators of the physical representation of capital, currency and bonds and stamps, one more woman, right, especially with the modern technology, nothing like having the Statue of Liberty come to life and call you up so that you buy a loan, right? So that's another way women are depicted. When it comes to the bureaucratic creators of the physical representations of capital, currency and bonds and stamps, the mighty United States Treasury Building stood in their stead. And I have to say, we have a version of this in our collection. It's the largest poster we have. It's something like 72 inches by 54 or something. It's really, really large. I mean, it was really meant to be in a railroad station, in a public space. According to historian Lynn Dumenel, for the first time, women's work was formalized and tied to a bureaucratic organization of the modern state, but I would say it was also hidden from view. Interestingly, fewer than 400 Liberty bonds exist today in the world. Of course, they're canceled, they're cashed in, and they're canceled, and they're destroyed. So it's interesting to kind of think about the material manifestations, the evidence we have for these working women at the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. So we let the Statue of Liberty and Thomas Jefferson do the work. Let me quickly add here that alarm bells usually sound, and I hope they're sounding, when we try to prove a negative, as I just tried to do there. Evidence is certainly hard to come by. The records on the for the Committee on Public Information are sporadic, they're incomplete. In lieu of outright evidence, preponderance of circumstantial evidence might make a case. What do we make of, for example, of the first case tried under the Espionage Act of 1917? The August issue of The Masses was banned by the United States Post Office for having anti-war cartoons, four of them, and anti-war text, and a poem. Not until the journal's editors requested an injunction were the offending materials revealed. So for a month or so, the editors don't know what was wrong with the issue, right? The first is Art Young's War Plans, in which the United States Congress is snubbed in the capitalist war plans. And you can see this here. Congress is this nice, meek guy, hat in hand. Excuse me, gentlemen, where do I come in? And big business replies, run along now. We got through with you when you declared war for the US. I'm sorry, I'm gonna need some water. And I get eucalyptus at the same time. It's so wonderful. I know. So I've been fighting off whatever's been going around for the longest time. So, all right. So the first is Art Young's War Plans. So that is considered something seditious. The second was Boardman Robinson's Making the World Safe for Capitalism, in which a seated worker contemplates a document entitled Plans for a Genuine Democracy at a table on which Workmen's and Soldiers' Council appears. Behind him, with a noosed rope called, bless your heart, called Advice. Cheers, everybody. Behind him with the noosed rope of advice is Nobel Prize winner Elihu Root, returned from Russia after the Tsar's overthrow, and Socialist Party member and journalist Charles Edward Russell. From the cartoon, you could see that neither of them can be trusted. The third cartoon, thank you, Ellen, I appreciate that. I got plenty. I'm getting my gallons worth today. Okay. The third cartoon, Conscription, depicts two men and a woman, right? Labor, youth, and democracy in that order, change to a cannon and its carriage as a woman and baby suffer. I should say that Clinton Camp is kind of interesting. Of all the authors and cartoonists that go, you know, that have to go to court because of not one court case, but two court cases over this this issue, he decamps to Mexico. So we don't really have his testimony. It's kind of interesting. Anyway, yet it's the last cartoon here in the center, an untitled image by Henry J. Glinton Camp, our man absconding to Mexico, that is the most interesting to me for our discussion. I think you see where I'm heading here. The second and third Liberty Loan drives use the Liberty Bell as the theme of the same as a theme as the same time the masses, editors, cartoonists, and writers endured two trials, one a hung jury, the other an acquittal, under the Espionage Act. The timing is so perfect to kind of think about the government responding to what's happening in popular culture, what's happening in the radical community, what's happening in labor and work, because they know they have to appeal to them. So I think there's something more here that warrants more research. Now, the story of American labor in World War I is pretty well known. Many movements for social change in the progressive era were framed in terms of labor, and the union movement was based on building a democratic, worker-run society not tied to capital. With Europe at war, orders for manufactured goods increased. With the end of European immigration, the American labor movement tightened. The increasing cost of living impelled workers to change jobs frequently in the quest for higher wages and better working conditions. Record labor strikes revealed this restlessness. 1,593 in 1915, 3,789 in 1916. Between the United States declaration of war on April 6, 1917 and October 1917, over 3,000 strikes were called in the United States, with the metalworking and shipbuilding trades leading the way, followed by workers in the textiles and clothing industries, then in lumbering, and then in coal and copper mining. The tight labor market lessened owners' resistance to trade unionism. The Wilson administration also knew that the war required workers and that it had to work with unions, but not all unions. So here is a moment in which workers realized that they could make great gains, and the state realized it had to work with unions. Yet the Wilson administration desired to work with only what they called responsible unions, such as the American Federation of Labor under Samuel Gompers. And the administration expected both labor and industry not to, quote, change existing standards, unquote, that is, not take advantage of the war emergency to make gains. It is no surprise then, oh, I should have had that up already. So just to kind of give you a sense of the feel of the moment of how much labor was needed, especially in the shipyards at Hog Island, which is a completely interesting story. It is no surprise then that government propaganda posters featured men in working in vital war industries, especially shipbuilding. Wilson had adopted a corporatist approach to that important sector, creating the Emergency Fleet Corporation at the war's outset to coordinate this vital industry. Now, one artist born in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Garrett A. Beneker, found work as what was called an expert aide at the U.S. Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. He is a most interesting character, and if anybody wants to do an exhibit on him, I will help. He's fascinating. Beneker was hired to produce images of concrete workers there for the Turner Construction Company for its company publication, The Mixer. I love concrete jokes, right? So anyway, let me go through. I forgot this one. So the last two that you saw in this one are kind of typical of the way labor is portrayed in government World War I propaganda. What's interesting about Beneker is that he used real workers for his images, as you could, you know. He, after the war, criticized those posters that did not, as he put it, appeal to laborers by showing real labor, that they were fake. And if I can go back for a minute on these, they really are, I mean, of course they're out of scale, right? You know, you've got the worker in the foreground and everything like that. But this is not the way you handle tools, right? And there's just some things that are kind of majorly wrong with both of these images. And whether they, you know, especially the one on the right probably did not have a model. It's also true of this one as well. As dramatic as it is, you know, we don't see dirt, we don't necessarily see a lot of sweat, although the hues in this kind of point to that. So Beneker, as an artist, is really looking at these in terms of what he would call authentic representation of and for labor, okay? He's also one of the few artists in World War I, commissioned to paint and features African Americans as subject matter. There is no government-issued propaganda poster out of the division for pictorial publicity that features an African American, just not a one. These are done commercially, like the ones that we have down in the exhibit, or they're done for these private firms that are contracting out to one of the military services. So it's very interesting. But later, and I actually just found this a couple of days ago, this is the only poster I've seen of an African-American soldier done for basically what was the United War Work Campaign, which was seven philanthropies combined together at the end of the war to raise funds. So this is kind of an interesting understudied aspect of Beneker's work, but also of what's going on in the private government balance that's being created in World War I and what you can depict and what you cannot depict. So, Beneker and his work provide an interesting case study of World War I propaganda imagery of labor. As a magazine illustrator, he kind of gets his start in around 1904 or so. He specialized in depictions of laborers in a variety of industries, but especially in railroads and automobiles, and even baseball players for Baseball Magazine. And it's kind of interesting because he actually does kind of look at baseball as a form of labor. And the images are rather fascinating to compare with his images of steel workers, for example. I should note that we know a lot more about Garrett Beneker a month ago because there was a big auction of his work on Cape Cod that had never been seen before. And so I think we're going to be seeing a lot more about him and his philosophies about art and labor in the coming years. It is likely why he was hired by the U.S. Navy Yard, because he had this long resume of these images, and likely why he moved from creating images for the Mixer to producing posters for the armed forces, producing posters similar to this one, I Will Back You, featuring a sturdy worker standing behind a Marine. Beneker's best known work, however, was Sure, We'll Finish the Job. There he is, and we have this downstairs as well. Produced in late 1918 and used in the last Liberty Loan Drive called the Victory Loan Drive in 1919. He recorded in his work ledger on December 9th, 1918, Edwards and Deutsch lithographers, delivered to Mr. Joseph Deutsch by hand at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, New York, two original oil full color posters, 30 inches by 40 inches each, on speculation. Received, as per agreement, $100 each to total $200. The next entry, dated December 12th, reads, one poster of workman, hand in pocket, wearing Liberty Loan buttons, was unanimously accepted by 12 heads of the 12 Federal Reserve districts assembled in Atlantic City. Congratulations by phone, telegram, and letter from Mr. Deutsch and Mr. R.W. Emerson, Chief, Division of Publications, Treasury Department, Washington, D.C. Now, I'm going to pull back and have an aside. I hate this poster, you know. It doesn't appeal to me a whole lot, and it's kind of like a little bit of a washed out yellow in the background. But can I take a vote? How many people find this appealing? Oh, geez, why?
I think it's a strong enough poster.
It is a strong enough poster.
It reminds me of my dad.
Sir.
Like a farmer.
He looks like a farmer. Interesting.
Common man,
yeah, absolutely. So I have to say we have many duplicates of this, and it's really interesting to think about the process by which these are made, because they actually have different hues as the inks change. So he's got a purple shirt, but we have ones with a blue shirt and kind of a pinkish purple shirt. So very much like we have some images of women, war workers in a poster, and she has lipstick on, but sometimes her lipstick is up by her nose and sometimes it's down by the chin. And it's kind of amazing how these things are really coming off the rotary, the offset lithograph printer to get these pushed out. So we have farmer, we've got sturdy, we've got dad. You know, these are all vitally important. And I think this is what Benecker was really getting at. This poster is often mistaken for a farmer, but I think that's okay. It does depict a laborer reaching into his left pocket of his overalls for money to purchase, of course, a Liberty bond. On his overalls bib are four Liberty Loan buttons, designating that he had purchased bonds in each of the previous four Liberty Loan drives. This poster, though, had another meaning, and I love the fact, this is from the Archives of American Art in Washington, D.C. They have Benecker's records. His daughters just gave them, and they digitized them, so it's a wonderful read. So there he is with his model. The poster had another meaning, though. Produced and distributed in 1919, the greatest strike year in American history, finishing the job meant staying on the job. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, some 20% of the national labor force, over 4 million people, walked off the job in more than 3,630 strikes in 1919. Tensions had already been mounting by the time Benecker submitted his poster and the Treasury chose it. The poster was issued in nearly 2 million single sheet posters of 30 inches by 40 inches apiece, and over 35,000 24-sheet posters, which basically is billboard size. They were all plastered all over the United States. At a tenth of a cent royalty, Benecker received $2,735.59. But he took pride in recording that on April 19, 1919, the Secretary of the Treasury, Carter Glass, in Cleveland told him, quote, my poster was the best one of all the loans and would do more to stop Bolshevism than any poster yet issued. He gave me a bronze button, end quote. Benecker was no radical. He was deeply conservative. He was a religious man as well. By the time he met Secretary Glass, he was working at the Hydraulic Press Steel Corporation in Cleveland, Ohio. He was paid $1,000 a month for 5 months work to use art, as he said, and I quote, a constructive force as moral in the labor capital situation. He saw art as an intervention to bring management and labor together. The workers at the Hydraulic Press Steel Corporation did not participate in any of the strikes during the Great Steel Strike. organized by the American Federation of Labor, that began in September 1919 and stretched to January 1920. This likely was proof to Banneker about the power of art and the corporation's management system. This is one of the images he produced. Most of these are in private collections, Menor Square. So he really did spend time out on the floors interviewing labor, then painting them. He had a studio in the building, rather fascinating, at a time when Cleveland is the sixth city in size. And I should say that the lithography part of this is rather fascinating too. We have the paint, the image here, but these do get reproduced. Another great topic is that lithography, even of Hollywood films at this time, are coming out of Cleveland and Detroit and Buffalo and Chicago because of the lakes and the trains. And the fact that you have ink makers and paint makers all around that. Within 100 miles around Cleveland, there were 90 paint and ink makers feeding that process. So when we think about popular culture and we think about media and we think about New York City, and then by the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, Hollywood, what's coming through is coming through the Great Lakes region and be a great dissertation for somebody. All right, back here, sorry.
What did square mean at that point?
True, fair, yeah, exactly. Authentic, right, yeah.
Not the way that it means.
No, exactly. I thank you for the clarification. I hadn't thought about that. So, he really ennobles the laborer. He really appreciates them, but he's thinking about this in terms, he also paints management, and they're just as heroic in a different sort of way, but still the same, all right? There's some equivalencies going on here in terms of the underlying morality and humanity he accords his subjects. Okay. Banneker's war posters, though, like those valorizing labor, did not quell the seething labor unrest throughout the steel industry at war's end. Indeed, these ennobling depictions of labor, like other government propaganda, stressed workers' essential role in the war for democracy. Workers had come to believe that the fruits of democracy would continue after the war. They took that propaganda and turned it around, right? Buoyed by the idea and the increasing number of union members outraged at the cost of living and working conditions in 1919, over 350,000 workers walked off the job and crippled the industry. The Great Steel Strike halted much of the nation's steel production. What they received for their work, however, was repression and a Red Scare targeting mainly immigrants amongst them. Owners controlled the public sphere, preventing public meetings and free speech, preventing parades, preventing union bosses from visiting their workers in their houses, and planting in newspapers stories that the strike was over in other places. So little by little, ebbing away, right, workers are believing that the strike is failing elsewhere and they're starting to return to work, which is good propaganda on the part of management. So lessons learned from the war. Anti-radical propaganda, again, had swayed hearts and minds, and in some ways, Banneker's work was part of that. For over a century, World War I propaganda posters have been analyzed in terms of government power, as artworks, and as precursors to the rise of mass advertising beginning in the 1920s. Much of this research has focused on artists and illustrators and not on workers in the lithography shops. The federal government featured artists in newspapers and films and public painting events, such as Albert Stirner on the preparing a lithographic stone for Over There. And this is a still from a now lost movie that the Committee on Public Information put out on how artists were helping to win the war, but not lithographers or paper makers or anything like that, right? And on the right, you see James Montgomery Flagg painting a large-scale version of Tell That to the Marines in front of the New York Public Library. There are a lot of these things going on, you know, even women getting up on scaffolding on the 46th floor in Times Square and painting a big poster, right? It's just amazing kind of hoopla to get the message across. We know very little, however, of the lithography workers who created the many millions of posters, placards, and other propaganda that persuaded Americans to support the war. Committee on Public Information Director George Creel argued that his work was as critical as shipbuilding and munitions manufacture. And so I end very close to where I began, looking for labor behind the posters and the unions behind the union labels. Thank you.
Well.
Now I will not be able to answer anybody's questions.
Yes, you will. We have faith in you that way. Well, the floor is now open for comments or questions about Shirley's presentation. Let me just do one quick commercial before we lose anybody to having to get back to their office. On April 17th, over across the street at the MSU Library, Charlie King is going to be doing his new musical show called Copper 1917, which basically is about one of those strikes that, that Shirley was alluding to, specifically an entire kind of song exploration of what was going on during World War I with repression. So I invite you over for that specific brown bag. It was on our list. With that, let me open it up to questions or comments. Mark?
Yeah, sure. This is just fantastic. Coming out of the Pacific Northwest, you know, I think we mentioned this, we were so struck the way that World War I was key to the suppression of the Wobblies, especially around timber and mining, but particularly timber, partly because General Pershing, for various tactical reasons, declared spruce a national security commodity, and any labor was the attack on the Wobblies on the IWW nationwide, or was it regional? Do you know?
Gosh, I don't know.
It just so happens I did a little research on
exactly.
that at one point in my life. The attack on the Wobblies starts, the industrial workers of the world are formed in 1905. They're formed in 1905 as a radical alternative to the American Federation of Labor. They are one of the earliest opponents to World War I, which automatically makes them suspect. There are a number of specific legislative acts, not only the anti-sedition stuff that was alluded to, but an entire set of laws across the United States called industrial syndicalism laws, and those were specifically aimed at the IWW. Then there are a number of, which you might know, Mark, or others would know, there were a number of killings of specific IWW leaders who were trying to organize. Frank Little was hung and all sorts of other awful stuff out in Idaho. Wesley Everest was someone who came back from World War I as a veteran and was ultimately killed during an attack on an IWW hall in the state of Washington. So there was a lot of anti-IWW activity across the nation, but a lot of it was centered in the Northwest because, frankly, that's where the IWW was very, very strong, so it would make sense that way. But they had headquarters both in Detroit and in Chicago, so definitely a Midwestern movement in that fashion. Other
Thank you, John.
Yeah, Mike?
Just an add-on. The reason spruce was in demand was for aircraft production. Mm-hmm. Now, ironically, we could not mobilize fast enough, so over in Europe, Americans flew French and British planes. The American aviation effort, the best thing was the Liberty engine. They're not American aircrafts. We built a few British models.
Okay, other questions? Yes, Bob.
The poster Men Are Square, how was that used?
Well, it actually was not a poster. It's a painting that actually was reproduced in magazines, right? Mostly for hydraulic steel press, but then it was borrowed by other magazines, and I haven't finished tracing everything out. Also, Banneker is basically has his own version of a whistle-stop tour. He visits universities, he talks to clubs, and he uses that painting all the time to talk about his work and this connection of, you know, labor and management. He's really kind of an apostle for this point of view. So,
what kind of magazines then?
These are actually company magazines, in-house magazines.
Okay.
Yeah, for the most part. Outlook picks it up though. A national magazine called Outlook picks up his ideas and reproduces those images. These images are produced. He wins an award at the Cleveland May Show. They have they've brought it back as the Neo Show. But every year, you know, the Institute of the Chicago Institute of Art, Cleveland Museum of Art, Detroit Institute of Arts had annual refereed shows that you could win awards. And then that kind of entered out into another part of print culture as well. So these, when I think about the posters, I'm really using a shorthand in some ways of this kind of reproduced image that starts spreading out into different sectors through print culture.
So it wasn't connected to the war?
No, he's doing it immediately afterwards though. So from what he's taking his ideas that he has in the war and then applying them to.
There's kind of three prominent V's in there.
Yeah, let's take a look at it.
Go back and there's his shirt and
yep.
his neck and then his fingers there.
Oh, that's so fabulous. Thank you. Well, absolutely, and I think that could be part of it, because he definitely is at that moment. He achieves the victory loan with that poster. He's been doing other images, which I didn't show, on spec, and all of a sudden after the war, so he does them before the war's end, and after the war they get reproduced all over the place, right? So I don't discount that at all, and it's a wonderful insight. Thank you.
I just want to point out you get an honorary doctorate at the end of today if you come back at 5:00. But
you can have my hood.
Mike?
So.
Piggyback on, you mentioned magazines. Did the industrial magazines at the time highlight the efforts of the workers?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well,
that was the one place where they did get recognition, but it was just within the industry.
Right. Now, for example, the concrete worker, the African-American, that was a fold, right? It was a thicker paper, and it was a fold in the Mixer magazine. And on the back, actually, and this is problematic because so many of the backs have now been linen cloth over, so that, you know, somehow protecting them, they actually had a nice kind of story of laborers and how they should go to work every day and how important they are to the vital war industry that they were in. And that's been erased just by what museums and historical societies do for conservation.
Well, one aside, based on Mark's original question, just so that we all are on the same page, the American Federation of Labor actually jumped onto the war effort and was part of, there was a labor board.
Yep.
That was created basically to spur the war effort and through form of cooperation. This actually spurred unionization not only in World War I, but a similar one spurred unionization because unions were okay during World War II. That is not to say, however, that there weren't an unbelievable amount of wildcat strikes both in World War I and in World War II against no strike pledges. So just to know that mm-hmm. was going on. So not only was the IWW regarded as an enemy, but naturally a lot of other unions were looked at a little bit askance just because of the fact that they were striking in the midst of, in effect, the national war effort. Other questions or comments? Yes, Ellen.
Yeah, Laura Bry. Laura Bry, yeah.
And I'm wondering if you could just speak for a moment about what you might know about her experience working in this medium and how her work was received and what kinds of obstacles she faced versus, let's say, Banneker.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Laura Bry, when you walk downstairs, you can see another version of it, our enlarged version on the in the foyer wall, and also on the title wall for the exhibit, and it's called Which Side of the Window Are You On? And it features a male figure lost in thought, a little hunched over, and he's looking out, and there's these military men walking by, and the flag is flying, and you know, it's that moment of decision, right? Are you going to sacrifice? Are you going to war? You know, which side of the window are you on? Laura Bry was actually an art student who hadn't finished her high school education when she went to the Art Institute of Chicago. And before there was a division of pictorial publicity, there were local schools, you know, art schools, universities, even high schools were sponsoring contests for patriotic paintings and posters. So another kind of wrinkle in the way these posters have been considered. Laura Bry wins $500 for that poster image. And it does get reproduced in Chicago. It does travel as part of a tour of posters to New York City. Laura herself would, in her late 30s, go back to a private school outside of Chicago and finish her education. Really interesting person. She never married. The one interview I found of her says she's 100% American because both her parents were German. Kind of interesting. And then she ends up working for Ma Bell and does art for the telephone company outside of Chicago for a little bit more of her adult life, and then I lose contact with her. I haven't been able to rescue her yet from you know, from the invisibility that she has. But she's kind of interesting. She never really gets a go at it in some ways as an artist. This, I think, you know, beyond what artwork I could find for the Bell Telephone Company and the sort of, like, you know, the covers of telephone books is what she's doing. And many, many artists end up going into commercial work after the war. Herbert Pauls, who you'll see downstairs, ends up working for the Detroit car makers and does these amazing magazine images, advertisements, in Saturday Evening Post and all that. So, yeah, but she kind of, you know, she had her moment, you know, and then that's it. And that's the amazing thing about many of the posters you see downstairs. A lot of these folks just, that's it. They went into illustration work, they went on Madison Avenue, they went into a different direction entirely. The two African-American posters we have by E.G. Renish of Chicago, a lithographer in Chicago, ends up his life selling real estate. So these are the stories that have yet to be told. So one day I'll have a book.
Maria?
And your answer is?
Probably not.
Nope.
I mean, the concrete industry isn't.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. No, no. Everything I have, and even his magazine illustration covers, are men. The work he did as artworks, he ends up going east. He lives on Cape Cod in Provincetown. He helps create the Provincetown Art Museum there. And a lot of his other work, his oil work, is about domestic scenes and portraiture of women. But his commercial work is all men.
Now, could I ask you to roll back to Teamwork Builds Ships? And while you're getting back to that, Mike, comment or question?
And it involves another slide.
Okay. Well, let me take you this one first. Actually, for those of you who are Ben Shawn fans,
yes,
that looks so much like Ben Shawn, it's an amazing thing. And especially given the fact that that's a very early kind of mature, what ends up being much more like a WPA image later. I'd love to find out who actually did that, because I think that is really quite a...
This is one I actually didn't... We have it in our collection. I didn't include it in the exhibit.
But oh, it's... Yeah. It's
fabulous. And it's huge. It's bigger than what we could have afforded.
It's a fabulous, fabulous piece of art. But then back to you, Mike, for another image.
Yeah, the United War
Okay.
The black soldiers.
You bet. Oop, sorry. There we go.
Yeah. Guy in the blue uniform is French Army.
Yeah.
Now, most of the black soldiers, one-fifth of the French Army, was from the colonies. It was the same style uniform, but it was khaki.
Right.
Though an American, I think it was the 92nd Division, they were farmed out to the French.
French, exactly.
They wore American uniforms, but French helmets.
Interesting.
Now the chap in the khaki uniform, I can't really tell if that's a U.S. uniform or a YMCA.
It is a YMCA uniform. He does have the patch right here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's hard to see. I'm sorry.
Okay, but I think the Foreign Legion, they were in the Horizon Blue. They did have some black soldiers, but predominantly, I just find that to be very interesting.
It's fascinating to me, especially given everything else that isn't produced. You know, depicting African Americans or blacks.
How great was the Y back then?
The Y really, very much like the Red Cross, grows exponentially because it really becomes a sort of wartime NGO for the government. The government really can't handle a lot of the things that it has to do, and so membership just skyrockets, and everybody starts wearing a uniform. Motor drivers, Girl Scout uniforms change because of this, Boy Scout uniforms change because of the war. Everybody gets a uniform, it just becomes the way you could serve, but it also becomes the way that a lot of conscientious objectors can serve too. And that's the other part of this. So there's a kind of spectrum going on here of getting into the war, but not getting into the war, so.
John?
Yes, have you looked at German things that were going on at the same time?
I haven't yet, and my late mother was German. She was a war bride for World War II. That's the other part of my story. And I should, because she would reach back from the grave. Actually there's a larger global interaction with imagery going on here. For example, the I Want You poster is based on a poster of Kitchener in Britain. Adolf Treidler, who you've seen a couple examples of, is actually accused of plagiarism of a German poster. And it becomes this problem in the Fourth Liberty Loan. So there's some things there that really could reward looking. I totally agree. So, but I haven't done it, sorry.
I'm gonna call on Mike next, but other people before I go back to Mike. Mike.
Okay, I noticed downstairs in some of the more classical ones, the women in body armor.
Yeah, yeah.
The Germans, the Boy Scouts, used a lot of that.
Absolutely, too. Yeah, yeah, so definitely. So I think, there is an issue of what kind of like specific images you use, but then there's like specific conceits, right, that's in the artist's toolbox that we could also compare. Definitely so.
One aside, because the IWW came up, there's a very famous cartoon, anti-IWW, of the Kaiser, mm-hmm. where the letters IWW form his face, basically form his nose, his mustache, and his mouth.
That's great.
And so, it was really meant to be a jibe at the IWW in that fashion. Other questions or comments? One quick aside, and then we'll any others we can bring it to a halt, and then go downstairs. And that is, if I remember rightly, isn't Jeanette Rankin, who you mentioned, one of the first women in Congress?
Yep, the first.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Progressive movements back then. Look what happens. Mike.
Also, was voted against the war, right?
Yeah, and World War II.
Right.
Yeah, both wars.
And the first place where women got the vote was the state of Wyoming.
Yeah.
So that whole Western thing, going on, we'll all have to wear hats. Okay, with that, why don't we give Shirley a round of applause?
Thank you.
So come back for Mother Jones at Local 602 on the 12th. Do come to all of our next brown bags. And if you haven't signed in, sign in, please. It's so nice to have you all here. Let's go downstairs and hear Shirley talk in the gallery.